Welcome to Let It Roll, We Dig Tales from the Tour Bus, where the podcast about how and why popular music happens takes a break to talk about our favorite animated music history show from Mike Judge with hosts Nate Wilcox and Justin Bankston. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Facebook, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. This week, Nate and Justin talk about the fourth episode of the funk season of Tales from the Tour Bus, featuring Bootsy Collins, the mighty funk bass player for both George Clinton's P-Funk and James Brown's JB's. Tales from the Tour Bus can be viewed on Amazon.com if you subscribe to Cinemax. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and joining me for a special We Dig Tales from the Tour Bus episode, Justin Bankston. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello, hello. And tonight, Bootsy Collins, Season 2, Episode 4. It's pretty epic.
My name is Bootsy, baby.
That's right. That's right. And pretty solid. I mean, we talked about the order of the episodes and how it would have been nice to have the George Clinton and the Bootsy Collins episodes together, because, boy, are they intertwined.
Absolutely. It's like the whole story is so amazing, the way that Bootsy and company just sort of filtered through all of these just, you know, massively epic parts of 20th century music.
Yeah, I mean, Bootsy and his brothers, the JBs, although they were known by various other bands at various points in time, and now I'm blanking on all the other names. Ack. But they absolutely rejuvenated James Brown. That's the thing about James Brown bringing in the JBs, which they talk about this. He used it as a labor-breaking method. You know, he's got trouble with the Maceo Parker version of the band, and he brings in Bootsy and company from the wine bar in Cincinnati, Ohio, who have no idea that James has been watching them and knows that they're ready to step in. Brings him in at the absolute peak of his powers, when he's perfecting funk, and at the perfect time for them to take it to that next level. And it's one of the most, it's right up there with Ozzy hiring Randy Rhoads. It's beyond that, but it's comparable to that, in that, you know, you've got an artist at the peak of the cutting edge, brings in a new crew to take it even further forward. It's amazing. And then Bootsy jumping ship and hooking up with George Clinton and P-Funk and just becoming absolutely essential parts of that arsenal. But we'll get to all that as we review the episode. So basically, structurally, pretty straightforward. I think it starts off with the James Brown and the JB's thing, but then it backtracks and just tells the story of their childhood. And it's pretty sweet, actually, the story of Bootsy and his big brother Catfish, who is effectively a father figure for him, and as their father's abandoned him, and Bootsy's just got his big eyes open and his big ears open when his big brother starts playing guitar and starts a band, and Bootsy's just lapping it up and secretly playing in the closet and gets busted. The brotherly beatdown segment. Did that offend your sensibilities?
Oh no, that would have been a mild day in my house.
Yes, indeed. I had five big brothers myself, and yeah, I remember once I touched my big brother's guitar and broke its G string, and yes, the brotherly beatdown was in full effect for that. And unlike Bootsy, I couldn't play. So, you know, but the story of Bootsy announcing, you know, he looks like he's about 12 in the drawings. It's hard to tell that you know, when his brother's bass player quits, and he announces, you know, get me four bass strings and I can play, and strings a guitar with four bass strings. And sure enough, he does it. I guess that's what talent is all about.
Absolutely. Yeah, the whole brother's band story is so terrific. You know, he's just watching his brother and idolizing him, and then just manages to work his way into his brother's band. And then they basically stick together, which isn't really explicitly laid out in the episode, but everywhere that Bootsy is, that he's getting all these accolades for being, Catfish is there too. All yeah. the way, like, they're in James Brown's band together, they're in Funkadelic together, they're in Bootsy's Rubber Band together, and Catfish even plays on Groove Is in the Heart, for crying out loud.
Yeah, with Delight in the early 90s. And Frankie Cashwaddy, the drummer, is there for much of that time as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, it's a tight crew. And this episode, I'm sort of jumping ahead of myself, but this episode is, there's a rise and a fall. And Bootsy overindulges and pays the price. But unlike so many other episodes in this series, it is not depressing because Bootsy beats it and has an extended ride off into the sunset. And as far as we know, he had to retire from stage performing this year, but he's still active in the studio and has been active playing with, you know, he's basically been a professor emeritus of funk all around the world for the last 20 years. And so I'd vote this is the least depressing episode of definitely this season, maybe the whole series.
I agree 100%. And I really enjoyed it for that reason, because even, you know, they almost manufacture the low point a little bit. Cause yeah, he, you know, runs out of steam and doesn't want to, you know, front a gigantic, you know, auditorium filling band anymore. And so he goes home and gets in a motorcycle wreck and whatever, but like, at no point is it taken away from him the way it is in so many of these other stories.
Yeah, I mean, the shingles, the case of shingles that horrifies Cashwaddy when he finds Bootsy in his mom's basement does seem pretty miserable. I mean, it seems pretty clear that Bootsy truly did not want to be a front man and have the responsibility of fronting a band, and that kind of ate him up. But, like, he uses James Brown's The One as the basis for his whole life philosophy, and he realizes he wants to get back to playing with a band and not being a front man. Does it? Problem solved. I'm sure it was more complicated than that, and that Bootsy suffered, as we all have in life, but you know, compared to Rick James and so these other terminal cases, George Jones, Johnny Paycheck, we're going to get to James Brown's epic tragedy. So, you know, Bootsy definitely keeps it on the sunny side, as it were. But yeah, so structurally, basically, other than the bit at the beginning about Bootsy and the JBs getting the call up with James Brown, it's straight chronological, starting his childhood in Cincinnati, Ohio, you know, getting recruited by James Brown, playing with James Brown, getting fired by James Brown, hired by George Clinton, the Funkadelic years, the Superstar years, and then off. It's got a good crew of interviewees. They got lots of Bootsy access, which is top notch. Although, did you notice the Mike Judge monologue at the beginning? They really lay it on thick about how unreliable a narrator Bootsy is, and I assume that's because of the heavy LSD use, but I don't get that feeling that Bootsy's distorted in the story.
Yeah, I think everything I hear Bootsy say in this episode sort of tracks as, you know, credible/reasonable, believable.
Yeah, with some perspective on it. Another interviewees, for the most part, we've seen all these guys in the George Clinton episode, or we'll see him again in the James Brown episode. You got Bootsy himself. You've got Cashwaddy, the drummer that he came up with and played with James Brown. We saw him in the George Clinton episode. We've got Alan Leeds, who is the Anglo tour manager for James Brown. This is his debut on the series, but he'll be back for James Brown. We've got Dr. Scott Brown, scholar of the funk, which is a position that I'm sure is hard earned, but he's new. And then mm-hmm. Tom Vickers is back, the P-Funk Minister of Information that George Clinton poached from Rolling Stone. George Clinton's back, and Stozo the Clown is back. So it's a pretty tight little crew, just a couple of outside commentators. Any thoughts on the interviewees for this episode?
I enjoyed them all. I mean, Cash Wadi is amazing, and it's so great because he's there for all of it. And so his counterpoint to Bootsy is terrific because he's the drummer. He was sitting back there watching it all happen. And he's also just got an incredibly killer low-key sense of humor that is just really awesome.
Yeah, and the fact that those, you know, a bassist and a drummer have a really close bond in a band, and the way those guys, you know, it's beyond tight. It's telepathic with those two guys, and not inventors of funk, but definitely advanced the funk. And Cash Wadi has plenty of insights, and it's just too bad we couldn't hear from Catfish as well.
Indeed.
But then the songs, and again, I feel like that the country episodes were a little bit better able to feature the songs than the funk episodes have been. I've noticed that the funk episodes, they tend to use a lot of the music in sort of a background capacity, and they reference Bootsy's Big Ballad, but they don't use the big ballads the way they did in the country episodes. But I think it's just the nature of the beast that funk tends to be up tempo party music, and you know, it's hard to beat country for the heartbreak ballad. So you got start out with Stretching Out in a Rubber Band, which is, you know, basically the theme song of Bootsy's Rubber Band, his solo vehicle that George Clinton pushed him into forming. Then you've got at least two songs with James Brown, Cold Sweat and Sex Machine, which are two of the epic tracks of American music in the 20th century.
100%.
Then there's what seems to be a bass break, and I couldn't identify the song. So I'd love to hear from anybody listening if you know what live tracks or whatever they were pulling the bass solo from. There's also some P-Funk stuff I couldn't identify. Then you got Bootzilla, which is another Bootsy's Rubber Band track, and Hollywood Squares, which is another Bootsy's track. I sort of feel like that Bootsy's best work is not as a front man. I kind of agree with Bootsy. I mean, Bootsy's Rubber Band is the kind of thing where I was actually impressed that they had three solid albums, and they are solid, hard-hitting funk. But compared with the absolutely apocryphal stuff he was doing with James Brown, and then the five-star stuff he was doing with George Clinton, I mean, the singing and songwriting just isn't there to the extent that it is on those P-Funk masterpieces that he was playing at the same time that he was doing. Feel like the music kind of suffers from the fact that they want to feature Bootsy's band over his work as a sideman.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I think there's definitely a bigger gap between the James Brown stuff and the Rubber Band. The Rubber Band sounds all very similar to Funkadelic to me. There's not just a huge difference in I mean, definitely George Clinton has an edge, like, on the songwriting, and, you know, Parliament has multiple great lead singers, but, you know, the general vibe and the general, you know, ass movement and party is coming pretty strong out of the Rubber Band, you know, really similarly to what you get from Funkadelic.
Absolutely. I mean, you get the feeling that, like, these tracks, you know, were probably laid down, and then they decide which project they're going to assign them to. I mean, you get that feeling. They might have just done these in dedicated sessions. Oh, we're going to cut Bootsy's album now and have all the tracks ready. But yeah, there's definitely, especially the instrumental backing, could be interchangeable with any of the P-Funk classics from that era. So it's question time. What's your favorite part of the episode?
You know, I think my very favorite part, and it's going to sound silly maybe, but Bootsy's laugh, every time he laughs during the episode, it is just an incredible delight. And it's just like, it's infectious and it's unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, Bootsy's just one of these lovable people, and he's a persona that I've been familiar with since, you know, my early teen years. And he's just gotten cooler over the years. There's never been a Bootsy backlash in my world.
Indeed.
What was your favorite part? Well, my favorite part had to be when they're assassin James Brown, man. When James Brown's coming at him with the you know, boot camp drill sergeant stuff, and they're just frying on acid and laughing in his face. It's it's just an epic generational clash. And for once, I'm on the side of the druggy hippies instead of the older generation. But it's just, you know, if anybody deserved that, it was James Brown all the way.
Indeed. And that whole sequence of the band versus James is just, it is just solid gold.
Yeah. And I think when Bootsy has the hallucination that James is turning purple and that lava is pouring out of his face, it's just epic. And he doesn't even seem scared. You know, he's just freaking out on it without being freaked out by it. You know, I mean, James Brown was so terrifying to so many people, but, Bootsy and company were not intimidated at all. So I just love it. Like, I think it was either Tom Vickers or Alan, I think it was Alan Leeds that referred to the Collins brothers as the drug culture on steroids.
Here they come.
Yeah. And when they dosed James Brown, actually, I think of all the confrontations with James Brown, it's when James accidentally hogs all the acid and drinks it all himself and then starts doing the dance that he calls the moon. And he's just standing there on stage for 15 minutes, stock still with his hands in a circle above his head.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. My heart stopped when in that whole scene where they're like, oh my God, they're dosing James Brown. Like James Brown, dosing him, and they're just letting it happen. And the whole animation of that, the whole part is just perfect. Especially when like James is just finishing the last little sip of the soda. He's just slurping the bottom, and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's absolutely classic. And you know, they're going to flesh James Brown out in the two parts about him. But in this episode, he functions as just a foil for Bootsy and a musical mentor. I mean, they acknowledge, you know, his greatness and that he taught him a lot. But as a character, he is totally one-dimensional, just the hard-ass authority figure that they can laugh at because he's ridiculous.
Yeah. But it was it was great to hear all about the one, and you know, I've heard about it my whole life, this idea from the James Brown one, and then just getting to see that sort of James to Bootsy to George, and then George making, like, as Bootsy says, like a whole concept out of it, and like calling it out in his own songs, talking about the one in the songs.
Yeah, over and over again. And I think it really highlights the difference between James Brown and George Clinton, in that, you know, James Brown was obviously a visionary musically, but was not a storyteller or a conceptualist in the same way that George Clinton was. I mean, George Clinton was creating this narrative, and like we talked about in the George Clinton episode, dropping concept album after concept album that even if, you know, it's like all concept albums for the most part kind of fall apart on close examination. But George Clinton is able, with just a few broad strokes, to get a theme going across an album. And he definitely wove the one into his mythology. And so that was kind of fascinating to me, to think about the differences between James Brown and George Clinton, insofar as Clinton being a myth maker and sort of a self-conscious storyteller, and James Brown just being mythic.
Yeah. I love the line too, where when he introduces the one to Bootsy, and he's like, you guys have got the baddest band in the land, but you just can't play though. It's just, okay, Mr. Brown.
Yeah, some of those quotes, I mean, and it must have been mystifying, you know, like, y'all the baddest motherfuckers in the world, but y'all can't play for shit, you know, and like, what? Although that's a miss, you know, Brown didn't cuss, so they probably didn't have him cussing either, but so I want to know that for the record, that James Brown was not a cursor. So out of the songs here, any songs stand out for you?
For me, like you said, it's a little hard. They don't really jump out as much, but I kind of, because as you said, it's sort of the theme. For me, I enjoyed Stretching Out in a Rubber Band in the context of this episode, because it's really kind of you know, the thesis statement of Bootsy's band and his thing. And so I really, that's my favorite tune.
Yeah, hard to argue with that. I got to go with probably Sex Machine, just because it's such a pinnacle of human achievement in my world that even if it's not central to this episode, I just, to me, nothing compares to that stuff. And it's just, you know, that's a track that I have listened to so many times. I've played along with and tried to understand and just cannot capture it all, you know. I mean, it's just such an amazing piece of work to this day, and the way the whole band becomes one rhythm section and every piece fits together so seamlessly, and yet every piece is also doing something you don't expect and just never can get the timing down, and it's just masterful. So, you know, anytime I'm hearing James Brown the JBs from that magical 18 months, that's gonna be my favorite. So,
yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that that song is by far the most important, like, out in the world. Like, it's you know, mountainous.
Yeah. And then I guess they did play probably a little bit of Groove Is in the Heart, or did they?
If they did, it was the tiniest bit.
Yeah, tiniest bit. And so, for I think for Gen Xers, especially Gen Xers who had MTV around the turn of the 80s to the 90s, that was a big song, and ended up being sort of historically important as a signpost for the electronic dance movement. And it's funny that, yeah, George Clinton was, you know, calling Bootsy out for betraying the funk and working on the disco side of the street. That funk versus disco thing is one of these conflicts that you don't often think about, but it's very real.
Yeah, and it dies hard, evidently.
Yeah, no doubt. Although Bootsy's able to straddle the fences. So, what was the funniest part of the episode? Have we already covered it, or there's plenty of laughs in this thing?
There are. I mean, I think all the funniest parts are during the James Brown stuff. And I think the very funniest parts are when I think it's Cash Wadi who's doing the funniest James Brown impersonation. But when he's like doing the sort of mumbly, can't really understand it, like James Brown, you know, shtick, it's just screamingly hilarious.
Yeah, it's definitely the laughs around the James Brown parts are rich and extensive. And the rest of it, it's funny, like the George Clinton stuff, as funny as the Parliament episode was, you know, there's not a lot of laughs in the Clinton-Bootsy relationship in this episode. And I guess it's just like when you got the James Brown relationship, classic foil. I mean, James Brown just sets himself up as such a straight man for their jokes because he's such a tyrant and he's oblivious to their drug taking. So he's just, you know, as much as they're missing the one when they first get there, he's completely missing, you know, the 60s awakening that's happening before his eyes, and just cannot even fathom what's going on.
Yeah.
And I sort of already jumped on this, but what was the saddest part of this episode to you?
Well, I mean, obviously, like, there's the sort of low point in the episode, the natural dip, which was, you know, it just wasn't all that sad because it didn't last that long. And it didn't seem nearly as dire as the ones in so many of the other episodes. You know, I was a little sad, you know, about Catfish because he just, you know, you hear his name a couple times and you get to see him early on when he's getting Bootsy going. But then just knowing that he was actually involved in every single thing that they talked about in this episode, and that we don't get to hear from him, that he's not with us anymore. That part bummed me out a little bit.
Yeah, I would like to have, and I know that they didn't because they didn't have time, but I would like to have heard a little bit more about Catfish. And I mean, he lived, I think he passed away about 10 years ago, so about 2009, 2010, something like that. So it's not somebody, you know, that we lost at a terribly young age, but I know that I'm sure it's just a devastating loss for Bootsy, and I think the hardest part of aging is losing your friends and family. And so, yeah, that's a sad note. But compared to like the Rick James two-parter, where one part is all the upswing and then the second part is not entirely downbeat, but it's a relentless ass whipping. And you know, by the time Rick James passes at the end of the episode, it's sad and it's hard. And I was just real thankful to Bootsy for keeping his shit together and staying healthy and productive, you know?
Indeed, absolutely.
Yeah, it's like, it's nice when nice guys finish first, because, you know, he's, you know, for 30 years now, he's had elder statesman status and just been a beloved figure in American pop culture and around the world. So loving it. And do we like the main character?
Yeah. I mean, what's not to like?
Exactly. I mean, there's no wife beating. There's no gunplay. There's no stealing. You know, it's just a good guy with a lot of talent and accomplishing great things. So, yeah, what's not to like?
The fact that he keeps his guitar player and his drummer with him the whole time tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah. That kind of loyalty is everything. And especially when you're working with somebody like James Brown, who was so expert at controlling people and often would set band members against each other, especially drummers, and the fact that he wasn't able to pull Cash Wadi away from the Collins brothers or pull any of his usual bullshit on them, it's very inspiring. And then the way they were absorbed into the P-Funk family, which was a crazy family, and a dysfunctional family, but not as dysfunctional as some of these bands. You know, compared to a lot of these big orchestras, you don't hear about, you know, George Clinton screwing people over, like, say, Captain Beefheart did or James Brown. So, you know, all good guys coming to a good ending in this episode. So we love Bootsy. So recommended listening.
There's so much.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. And more keeps coming out. I mean, they came out a couple years ago with an album that the JBs recorded right before they became the JBs, which is pretty fun to listen to. But basically anything that James Brown laid down with the JBs in that year and a half, 2 year period where they were together, definitely worth getting. And it's the James Brown discography is such a hairball because, you know, he had this weird deal with King Records and then with Polydor and wasn't thinking in terms of albums necessarily, or his albums that came out at the time, or, you know, it'd be like a classic single with the B-side, which would usually be the extended, you know, version of the song, plus some random stuff that he recorded 3 years earlier. And just it's the kind of thing that if you're really going to get anal retentive about it, you need to get some discography books and really sit down and make your own playlist. Because to me, the best way to listen to the James Brown stuff is the box sets. But then again, you've got to pick out, if you're just trying to hear the JBs, it's a little bit complicated, but you know, I'm just going to run some of the classic tracks they recorded with James yep. Brown. Sex Machine, Bewildered, Super Bad, Soul Power, Talking Loud and Saying Nothing, Love, Power, Peace, The Grunt. These are the JBs. I mean, those are some extremely notable tracks, but like I said, everything that they played with James Brown is not just well worth hearing. It's an absolute must listen.
Absolutely. And as you said, it's kind of frustrating because there's not like that I could find a studio album you could point to that's front to back James with the JBs playing, you know, 9 or 11 songs all together. It's like everything is sort of a hodgepodge. Like the best songs with the JBs lineup are on maybe double albums that have all kinds of other stuff with the previous band on it, and they work as records, but if you're trying to like zoom in on this, it's maddening.
Yeah, it's absolutely maddening, particularly because, you know, James's music and his persona were so overwhelming. I mean, even with a talented red hot band like the JBs, you know, of young bloods that are absolutely on the cutting edge, he molds him to his vision so relentlessly that, you know, I certainly am not qualified. If you play me two James Brown tracks from, you know, one from 68, one from 70, 71, I'm not going to be able to tell you which one is Cash Wadi on the drums and which one is Clyde Stubblefield or anything like that. So,
yeah, me neither.
It's, and there are people who've devoted, you know, their whole listening lives to this stuff. And it's, well worth it, but it's not my specialty. Then, like, I think the P-Funk stuff we covered on the George Clinton episode, but Bootsy, basically everything after 1972, Bootsy and the Collins brothers are on, especially, you know, Parliament's Up for the Downstroke, Mothership Connection, Funkadelic versus the Placebo Syndrome. I mean, Funkadelic's Down on the Verge of Getting It On. I mean, just the classic concept albums. Bootsy is absolutely integral to George Clinton's musical vision on all those. And then the first three Bootsy's Rubber Band albums are all solid. Stretching Out in Bootsy's Rubber Band, The Name is Bootsy Baby, and Bootsy Player of the Year, which for some reason that one took me a little bit to track down. I had to check Spotify, but they didn't have it on Google Play, so I had to buy it and upload it there. And then you had a couple of
others.
Yeah,
they didn't have it on Spotify.
They didn't.
Yeah.
So... so that was annoying, but you can still find it on CD and upload it to Google Play. And then you had a couple of tracks from there's like a 20-year period where Bootsy's a guest star on all kinds of places. I'm not the big Keith Richards solo records fan, but he's on that with Delight. Yeah. You know, Groove Is in the Heart, the singles classic, but you had a couple you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I'm a big Bill Laswell fan, and he just has done all kinds of insane stuff. But one of his sort of bigger projects is called Praxis, and the first Praxis record, which is called Transmutation, has got Bootsy as the bass player and sometimes vocalist on it. And it's nothing. It's not nearly accessible like this other music we're talking about. But if you like just bizarro, weird stuff. That's of a very high quality. The Praxis album, Transmutation, is just absolutely worth checking out. And it's like a window into like Bootsy's willingness to just do whatever, you know. And I really like that about it. And then also, I think everybody should watch the Fatboy Slim video, Weapon of Choice. Because it's an incredible video featuring Christopher Walken, and it's also another great Bootsy bizarro world collaboration.
Yeah, Bootsy seems like the kind of person who's A, so talented he can, you know, if he can hear it, he can play it. He's going to have ideas, and he's got his own sound, so he can, you know, has something to contribute. And he's beloved, so he's been invited to be on just this amazing wide range of things. I think I could spend quite a bit of time just down the Bootsy solo or, you know, guest spot rabbit hole. So
it's for sure
put on my list to do. So we discussed a little bit, but this episode obviously serves as a bridge between the season opener with George Clinton and then the upcoming two-parter with James Brown. Any thoughts? I mean, they pretty much had to put it right here where they did in this season's flow.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited to talk about the James Brown two-parter because, man, there's a lot going on in there. And it's really nice to get this sort of set up here with the sort of lighter side of the James Brown situation and his interactions with, you know, the Cincinnati boys. It's definitely like a nice, mellow sort of palate cleanser before you dive into the James Brown episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I guess they could have put the Morris Day episode before this one, but, you know, I don't know. I like the way they did it because the Morris Day and the Rick James episodes kind of all are tied together by Prince. And the James Brown and George Clinton episodes have the Bootsy connection. So, you know, yeah, no arguments about where they place it. Like we said, I'm still not 100% sold on having the Rick James episodes between the Clinton and Bootsy, but I can't figure out a better way to lay out the cards than they did. So I can't complain there. And then I did want to bring up one note that we forgot to bring up on the Rick James episode last time, and that was the Sly Stone appearance in there. And, you know, if anybody is the second, I don't want to say second banana, but if anybody is the number two man in funk history, it's Sly Stone. Like, James Brown is obviously the one, but Sly Stone absolutely innovated and pushed James Brown. And I think before Sly Stone, you know, it was like James Brown is doing this weird thing and nobody quite knew what to call it yet. And then you get some one-offs like Archie Bell and the Drells Tighten Up and some other pieces where people are doing funk. But Sly Stone, once Sly and the Family Stone come out, it is a form and it's clearly a whole new thing. And, you know, James Brown invents it, but Sly Stone takes it and runs with it. And so, you know, when you get a series like this and all Sly Stone gets is this one cameo in one episode where he is just serving as a drug casualty. Yeah. And a warning for Rick James, it's not heated. To me, that's really heavy. And apparently they wanted to do Sly Stone, but the music publishing was too difficult to acquire. So that's from the Nelson George interview you turned me on to. So I just wanted to bring that up that you know, they know Sly Stone exists. They wanted to cover him, but there were difficulties. And also, you know, Sly is still alive. He has been dealing with cocaine addiction for the past 45 years at this point. And so he's a very difficult character to deal with. And all
indeed,
of his business.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what it would be like to try and do this, you know, while Sly's still alive and with the reputation he has at this point. It would have been quite the undertaking. But I agree 100% that Sly and the Family Stone are just massive in this world. And in my mind, they sort of, you know, they sort of pioneered the sort of bigger, crazier, cartoonier sort of version of funk that really then Funkadelic took up. And then, you know, eventually Rick James, you know, took to such huge success. And it was sort of like a bigger sort of wackier sort of version of what James Brown was doing. It's sort of like a larger than life, you know, sound. And
yeah,
they really sort of took that turn. And, you know, they were monumental, no getting around it.
Yeah. I think Sly's big contribution was that he took James Brown's funk template. And it wasn't like he was just imitating James Brown. I mean, there were a lot of elements into it, but he was very hip to what James Brown was doing. But he took that funk template, and James Brown was many things, but he really was not a pop song stylist. And Sly Stone showed that funk could serve as a framework in which you could do pop songs, and great pop songs, and meaningful pop songs, and big statements, like There's a Riot Going On, you know, album length statements. So yeah, I mean, you can't understate the importance of Sly Stone, nor can you understate the epicness of his story, because it's such a reversal from, you know, a guy who deliberately set out to create a racially integrated, sexually integrated band that was super positive and such an expression of the hopes of the late 60s, and then turns into, curdles even into, such a negative embodiment of all the things that went wrong after that brief idealistic period. So yeah, you know, heavy story. Hopefully someday, if not Mike Judge, somebody worthy, you know, I'm sure if Nelson George would be perfect to be involved in a project like that. So someday we'll get a Sly Stone documentary, but I'm afraid it won't be until he passes. So
yeah,
that's our episode. Bootsy Collins, Tales from the Tour Bus, Season 2, Episode 4. And we'll be back next time to talk about James Brown.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Facebook. And check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at @LetItRollCast. Come back next Thursday as Nate and Justin will be back to talk more Tales from the Tour Bus Season 2 featuring James Brown. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Tales from the Tour Bus can be viewed on Amazon.com if you subscribe to Cinemax.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.